Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is All of It. I'm Kusha Navadar filling in for Allison Stewart. Whenever you've lived in one place long enough, you start to remember what used to be. A community garden that used to be here, or a concert venue that used to be there, a bank that used to be a deli, an urgent care that used to be a bar, or a restaurant that used to be a different restaurant. That used to be a different restaurant. A new exhibit at the New York Historical Society called Lost New York explores some of these places in the city's history. It features paintings, photographs, objects. We're talking about places like the Crystal Palace that stood in what we now call Bryant Park, and cultural trends like the river bathhouses that used to be super popular. You can check out Lost New York now through September 29th, and here to discuss it is Wendy Nalane Ikemoto, Vice President and Chief Curator of the New York Historical Society. Wendy, welcome to All of It.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
And listeners, tell us about a piece of New York you remember that's been lost to time. Maybe it's an old business that closed down, a concert venue, a restaurant, a deli, or one that just got a major redesign. Maybe it's a public space that's been replaced by housing or a demolished building. I mean, it could even be a small thing, like a piece of art or graffiti or an activity that you used to attend. Give us a call. Send us a text. We'd love to hear from you. The number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. You can also hit us up on social. We're at All of It WNYC. Now, Wendy, let's get started with the exhibit. It's about lost pieces of New York history, and that seems like a natural one for a museum called the New York Historical Society. And it's actually kind of surprising that it hasn't been done before. So where'd the idea for the exhibit come from?
That's a great question. It did grow out of our collections, for sure. The idea was always floating in the back of my mind because of the nature of our collections. We collect New York history, we collect New York art, and New York is constantly changing. That's the constant change. And so a lot of the pieces that we bring in, even when they are contemporary at the moment we acquire them, they become representative of a lost New York. But the idea really started to crystallize in 2022 when we acquired two very large paintings by a contemporary artist named Richard Haas, which traced the loss of a 1855 view of Midtown Manhattan and beyond. We're looking at a pair of paintings. They show a view from the same vantage point, but they're separated by time. One is a view from 1855 and another from present-day New York.
And what are the themes, or I guess the ideas that you are trying generally to convey in this, thinking about change, as you say, being the only constant in New York?
We look at a number of themes. We look at lost landmarks, lost monuments, lost communities, lost modes of transportation, lost pastimes. And I think the aim is to have visitors dive into the many and deep layers of New York's past, and also to think about the importance of preserving that past and the importance of interpreting it, the importance of thinking about how it resonates today.
Mm. Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking to Wendy Ikemoto, who's the Vice President and Chief Curator of New York Historical Society. We are talking about their new exhibit called Lost New York. It goes through pictures, objects, places of what yester century of New York used to look like. There's a lot of fascinating, eye-opening different pictures to show kind of the slice of life of New York back in the day. And we want to hear from you. What are parts of New York that you miss? Buildings, activities, things like that. Graffiti, pieces of art, whatever. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Wendy, we just got a text that I want to point out that I want to go to a call. It says Fat Albert on Broadway in Brooklyn. We've also got a caller here, Lindy in Manhattan. Hi, Lindy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. What I miss so much is Louis Lichtman's Bakery, which was on the southwest corner of 86th Street and Amsterdam Avenue in Manhattan. And my friend and I used to stop in there every day after school for a chocolate eclair. It was such a wonderful neighborhood bakery. It's actually on the block where Only Murders in the Building is filmed.
Oh, that's wonderful. Lindy, thank you so much. Wendy, I'm listening to Lindy, restaurants are probably a big part of everyone's relationship with the city. Did you see anything like that in your collections, or does your collection have anything that deals with the way people ate, the places that they used to gather?
Yes, well, actually, we have a recent example. We feature an Al Hirschfeld drawing of the 21 Club, and we have a respondent. We feature community labels throughout the exhibition, and one of our community writers talks about visiting the 21 Club on his 30th birthday. Mm-hmm. So just like the Lindy's story, his story helps to bring that site back to life.
Mm. What was one of the first images or objects that you knew belonged in this exhibit? And I know that you mentioned the two Haas paintings that were really big and that kind of set off this whole course of events. But once you started diving deep, was there something where you thought, oh, wow, I'm really excited about that one?
Well, I'm really excited about a painting by an artist named Riley, which features a pig on the Bowery.
Yeah, seven and a half Bowery, right?
Yes, seven and a half Bowery. The reason I was so eager to feature that in the exhibition is that when I started at the New York Historical Society about 6 years ago, I read about the institution and I read that it was founded in 1804 when pigs roamed the streets of Manhattan. And I thought, really? And so finally, I have a chance to tell that story with this exhibition.
Wow. Do you know why pigs were allowed to roam? Like, what was it about New York back then? Was there just more livestock walking around? Was there any history that you found as part of that?
There was livestock walking around. It actually started back with Dutch colonization. The Dutch would complain about pigs walking around the city, and they reached their height in the 1820s. There were about 20,000 pigs wandering around New York City that equated to one pig for every five people. And they were fascinating. They acted as our first sanitation crew, eating garbage off the street. But at the same time, they blocked traffic and they smelled and they were thought to spread disease. So there was a lot of uproar over the population of pigs. Even Charles Dickens visited New York City in 1842 and wrote about encountering two portly sows and a coterie of about half a dozen gentlemen hogs who were wandering about the bustling skirts of the ladies in the carriages.
Wow. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Wendy Ikemoto, who's the vice president and chief curator of the New York Historical Society, and their new exhibit, Lost New York, is on view now through September 29th. We're taking your calls about parts of New York that you miss. We're talking buildings, institutions, even pieces of art that you would see around the city. We've got a bunch of calls, so let's get to them. Let's start with Maria in the Bronx. Hi, Maria. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I used to live in Brooklyn in the 90s, and I love to walk through Court Street and Smith. And right there in that neighborhood, there was this beautiful vintage store called George's Potpourri. It sold all vintage dinnerware, soap dishes. I still have a soap dish that I bought there. And then back on around 2007, 2008, it disappeared. I went looking for it, and it had become a restaurant. The owner, George, died, and I guess it was sold.
Maria, thank you so much for that call. It sounds like restaurants end up popping up in places that we love a lot, and restaurants themselves are things we love as well. Let's go to Alan in the Berkshires, actually. Hey, Alan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much, and thanks for taking my call. When I first moved to New York in 1981, I was making $13,000, and I was always looking for inexpensive things to do. In the bottom of Carnegie Hall, there was a movie theater. As you walk down the stairway, which was quite long, the lobby of the theater was decorated like an outdoor French Parisian cafe with murals on the wall, a little table set up. And there would be a guy often playing organ before the movie. So you'd go into the movie theater, and there'd be someone, I don't know who he was, but he would be playing a pipe organ. And you'd have probably a 5 to 10, maybe sometimes 15-minute concert before the movie started. And it would cost about $2 or $3. It was just a terrific thing to do. They played a lot of old classic movies. It was not first run. And I think the space has been converted into a more formal concert hall right now.
Oh, interesting.
But it was a terrific find, and it was a lot of fun, and it just had a lot of character and panache.
Yeah. Alan, thank you so much for that call. Wendy, I saw you nodding your head about the organ player. Do you have a response to that?
It just brought up memories for me. I grew up in Hawaii, and we used to have an organ player at the movie theater that I went to as a child.
Oh, wow. I guess across the country, it's a similar mm-hmm. experience. We just got a text that I would be remiss not to point out. It reads, not to point out the obvious, but I miss the Twin Towers, which I think is mm-hmm. an important reflection to right. have as mm-hmm. a part of New York's big history. Let's move on. Let's go to Gardner in Inwood. Hi, Gardner. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call. This is really interesting, and I love the Historical Society. I remember this really amazing and crazy mural over on a building on 6th Avenue just above Canal Street, and this is back in the 80s. I grew up down there, and just seeing this really spooky kind of otherworldly massive artistic mural with like a body on fire. I mean, it was very surreal. And just sort of felt like something you don't see anymore, especially in a busy area that, you know, used to be artistic and is now very, very shishy, just above Tribeca. So I loved that, and it's gone. I don't know who it was or if there are any pictures of it anywhere, but I loved it.
Oh, Gardner, thank you so much for that call and for bringing in art, because art is a huge part of New York's history, right, Wendy?
Art is history. I'm an art historian, and I like to point out that paintings, drawings, they are not just illustrations of the past. They are pieces of the past, and they are agents in shaping our history.
Yeah, listeners, we love taking your calls. If you're just joining us, here's what we're talking about. We're talking to Wendy Ikemoto, who's the vice president and chief curator of the New York Historical Society. Their new exhibit, Lost New York, is on view through September 29th. It is a retrospective of some of the most memorable, most striking places that are gone from New York City's landscapes. Buildings, pieces of art, activities, and you can go there and kind of get a sense of what New York used to be like through the centuries. Activities is a big part of it, and I think bathing culture is one thing that stood out to me when I was looking through the collection, Wendy. Bathing culture features prominently in the objects and the artwork. There are small cast iron statues of people in bathing suits and many drawings of swimmers. So can you say, how did the bathing element of the exhibit start to emerge?
Yes, so I used to be a swimmer, mm-hmm. and so I was really struck by this history, the fact that New Yorkers used to plunge into our city's rivers on a regular basis in the summer, despite the very dangerous tidal currents and despite pollution, not only from industrial waste, not only from human waste, but also from blood from slaughterhouses. Mm-hmm. So you have to wonder, why did they do this? Why did they risk their health? And the answer is they needed a way to beat the heat. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've been in a New York City summer, you know how hot it gets. And this was before the widespread adoption of air conditioning. And for those who couldn't afford to escape the city, they needed to find a way to cool off. And so they plunged in and they made a day of it, and they brought inner tubes and they rocked in the wake of the ocean liners, and they fished and they crabbed and had a fun time. And it's shocking to think today, but it was a common pastime, and people still do it today. But at the time, there was actually debate over which would make you sicker, the summer heat or the pollution from the waters. So it really was driven by public health.
Oh, wow. And there were bathhouses, right? What were some of the memorable bathhouses?
There were also bathhouses. Two of them opened in 1870, one on 13th Street in the Hudson River, one on 5th Street in the East River. And they were a response to the dangerous tidal currents in the rivers. So city politicians were trying to get swimmers to go not into the rivers, but into these protected river bathhouses, which were basically floating structures with a deep well that still allowed river water in. Mm. So you were still swimming in the pollution, but you weren't subject to the tidal currents. Mm.
There's another one that I want to bring up before we get to more calls. There's a 19th century painting of the New York Crystal Palace, which used to stand at the site of present day Bryant Park, which blew my mind when I saw it. What was the building used for? Can you describe what made it remarkable?
It was built for the 1853 exhibition of the Industry of All Nations, which is often considered New York's first World's Fair. So the first safety passenger elevator, for instance, debuted there. It was an exposition of great industry from across the globe. And it was modeled after the Crystal Palace in London. And it sat right next to the Croton Reservoir, which is where NYPL stands today. And if you go to the lower level of NYPL, you can still see fragments of that Croton Reservoir. At the time, the two structures really contrasted with one another. One was this weighty, stone, heavy structure with Egyptian styling, and the other was this light and airy glass crystal palace.
Let's go to some more calls. We've got Perry in South Orange. Hey, Perry, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. This is great. I'm remembering the late lamented Bottom Line, an incredible music venue in the West Village that became subsumed by the NYU campus.
Mm. Perry, thank you so much. Let's go to Barnard in Manhattan. Hey, Barnard, welcome to the show.
Hi. Yeah, I remember one aspect of living in East New York, Brownsville, the railroad that went by and caused my bed to move. The ground reverberated. But the more pleasant one was going to the corner store and getting a half pint of cherry vanilla ice cream. And I remember him scooping out all of that ice cream and saying, my God. And I happened to be 93 years old. Mm. So that was during the 1930s. I'll never forget the ice cream.
Oh, wow. Is that your favorite flavor of ice cream now, Bernard?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that call. And let's go. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Were you going to say
could
something?
Could I just chime in? I love the stories from the 1930s, and we're actually looking for somebody who maybe remembers seeing Augusta Savage's Lift Every Voice and Sing Monument from the 1939 New York World's Fair, as well as somebody who maybe ate at Klein's lunch counter in the 1930s.
Oh, so you are looking for people right now.
We are still looking. I want to treat it as an organic growing project.
So if there are people listening right now that have something like that to contribute, how can they get in touch? What would you suggest they do?
I think they can email responses@nyhistory.org.
Responses@nyhistory.org. All right. So if you're listening and you feel like you have something to contribute to the New York Historical Society, responses@nyhistory.org is the place to go. Let's hear from Susan in Brooklyn. Hey, Susan, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks. What's your contribution?
And I Googled it online, so it's not just my memory failing. There was a Camel cigarette billboard in 1964 in Times Square that would blow actual smoke rings out into the air.
Oh, wow. Do you know when that stopped happening?
I don't know when it stopped. Probably when smoking became it became illegal to have ads for cigarettes.
That must be it. Yeah, Susan, thank you so much. You know, I want to get into communities as well because this is an element that's really important to the exhibit. Communities that no longer exist have changed significantly are also represented in the exhibit. I'm thinking of Louis Saida poster, for instance. There's a painting of the first Chinese language theater on the East Coast, which opened in 1883. In Chinatown. How did you want to explore these neighborhoods and communities through the exhibit?
Well, it was really important that we do our best to represent the racial and socioeconomic diversity of this city. That's one of the defining aspects of New York. So the Chinatown painting is really fascinating. It was painted in 1899 by a man named Samuel Northcote, and it's called Hai He Chinese Theater. And our community writer actually points out that this is probably a title that emerged from a cross-cultural miscommunication, mm-hmm. because Hai He in Taosinese is actually a verb that means to go to the theater. So she imagines this conversation between the white artist Samuel Northcote and the theater goer. Where are you going? I'm going to see a show, mm-hmm. and that becomes the title of the theater, according to the artist.
And how did you engage with the communities of these different communities themselves, whether they were there or not, in order to inform how you talked and what you showed about in the exhibit?
Right. We reached out through multiple networks to contact people from these communities and make sure that their stories are heard and told in relation to the works that represent these lost places.
Wonderful. There's a text that just came through that I want to read as well. It says, "Hi, WNYC. I want to reflect on the memories of losing the famous Conway's department stores in every borough. There was one on 34th Street, Manhattan, Jamaica, Queens, and Fulton Street, Brooklyn." You know, Central Park is another big one. We're wrapping up soon, but I'd love to talk quickly about all of the ways that you showed Central Park in the exhibit, even though it's still around. How did you think about capturing locations in the park?
Well, one of the vignettes centers around a new acquisition of a drawing of the Central Park Hooverville, which stood where the Great Lawn now stands. And the other vignette we have related to Central Park is about Seneca Village, a largely middle class black community that was founded in 1825. And these community members were evicted in 1857 when the city claimed that land by eminent domain to make way for Central Park.
Mm. And, you know, in the minute that we have left, what have you learned about New York City? What's a small detail or in the grand scheme from working on this exhibit?
That's a great question. As I said, I'm not from New York. And so I feel like it's just, for me, it's a chance. Every exhibition is a chance to learn more. And I feel like I've almost become I should be an honorary New York City tour guide.
Well, at what point do you feel like you become a New Yorker? What does that feel like for you? When does that happen?
Well, I've heard it said that, you know, if you're walking down the street and you miss something, so that, as you said in your opening, a store used to be here, a restaurant used to be here, and I've reached that point already, so I suppose.
And what for you? Like, let's put the question back on you. What is a thing that you miss in the city from the time since you've moved here?
Well, Century 21 used to be right by where I live. I know it's, you know, I think about it because one of the works in our exhibition features Century 21, among other businesses that closed in the wake of the pandemic.
I'm going to read some more texts in the time that we have left. We've got Fish Market in Seaport, Alexander Hardware Store on Duane Street, and the sex shops and live shows on 42nd. And we've got this text that says, "No matter how long you've been here, you are a New Yorker the first time you say, that used to be Munsey's or that used to be the TikTok Lounge." Kind of like what you were saying, Wendy. It seems like as soon as you're able to say, "Oh, I remember when," maybe that's an entry point into New York. Feels
sure.
Right. So Wendy Nalani Ikemoto is the vice president and chief curator of New York Historical Society. Their exhibit, Lost in New York, is on view through September 29th. You can go check it out and see what it used to be like in New York centuries ago or even just a couple decades ago. Wendy, thank you so much.
Thank you.